With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I am joined by Heidi White and Adam Andrews. Heidi, Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, David.
Good to be here. Good to be back.
So we are here to discuss, we're just here to go further up and further in with Ralph Moody's Little Britches. We're going to talk about chapters 11 through 16. If you don't have it labeled properly in your book, chapter 11 is haying, and then chapter 16 is a good month with no school. So we will talk about we're gonna talk about those chapters here in a minute. Quickly though, Adam, anything you want to talk about just in general? Just if you have 1 minute to talk about anything you want to talk about.
You put me on the spot. I can't think of a single thing, although I'm glad, I'll tell you this, I'm glad I don't live in a place where you have to hay.
Well,
or live at a time when you have to hay.
I was going to say, there's probably plenty of haying done in the Pacific Northwest. Just don't have to do it now.
Yeah, a lot of this book is reminding me how grateful I am to live in the era and the location that I do. Although, I mean, his childhood is wonderful, and there's glorious things about it, and all the important things are taken care of. But man, oh man, I sure do like modern conveniences.
Like microphones and bathrooms and stuff.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. But not together.
Why not? It's a false dichotomy. So Adam, before I turn it over to Heidi, what is up at the Center for Lit that you want to tell people about? Because you are, after all, the Grand Poobah? What's the you're the guy that's in charge over there at the Center for Lit.
Yeah, things are going well. We just opened up our early registration period for our online academy and are telling everyone we can tell about that, giving big tuition discounts for kids that want to join our classes for the fall. Nice. And we've got classes in grades 5 through 12 featuring the Center for Lit approach to literary discussion, Socratic discussion. And we've been having a great time with those for the last 10 years. This is our 10th season going into online classes, and we're really enjoying it. So that's the main thing.
Are you teaching anything new this year that you've never taught before? Maybe you haven't taught in a while before, say that.
Well, our elementary and junior high classes are on kind of a rotating book list. So we actually teach new titles every other year or every third year in those classes.
Okay.
And then we tend to cycle one or two titles as new ones at the high school level as well. So we may be doing some Dostoevsky this year in the World Lit class. We're going to do Leif Inger's Peace Like a River in the American Lit class. We don't do that every year.
Is a great book. I've never taught that book, but that's a great one.
Yeah, we love it.
That's on the Close Reads shortlist for the future.
Oh, is that right?
Perfect.
Yeah, it's a favorite of ours over at Center for Lit. So yeah, Online Academy early registration period is kind of the main news that I have to share.
Centerforlit.com, I assume?
Centerforlit.com, exactly.
Heidi, what are you up to?
Well, I'm getting ready to teach this webinar over at the Searcy Institute next week on the history of the Holy Grail. And I'm so excited about it. It is such a fascinating and mysterious story, legend. The development of the legend's really cool, and not a lot of people know about it. So I'm excited about that.
Nice.
And then I also got to prepare another talk for the Searcy Institute for the regional conference that's coming up in May, and that's going to be a really good one too. So David, maybe you could tell us about that. You can find out online.
Yeah. Well, to find out about that webinar, people can just head over to our website or find it on social media. You know, if you go to the CircyInstitute.com page, you can click on events and it should show up there.
The Informa. We got that coming out.
Ostensibly. We do have a regional conference coming up in May, and I think I've mentioned this before, but basically the theme is reliving the journey, reliving the journey, recovering the wonder. Yeah. It's just the idea that when you teach something, you often have to go back to the beginning, or at least be empathetic enough with your students to be able to go back to where they are, because as teachers, we often, you know, we know what we're talking about. So you have to figure out, how do you get to the place where you are, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. How do you be able to empathize with the student who isn't there? So we're going to talk about that and a lot of ideas related to that. And that's in May. So if you would like to, if you're in the Southeast, or well, I guess if you're anywhere and you want to fly in, but especially if you're in the Southeast and you want to join us, that's May 11th, I believe, here in Charlotte, or here in Concord, actually, pretty close to our offices. So that's coming up. But yeah, all right, let's talk about this book. Enough chit chat. Stop talking so long, guys. Okay, so before we hit record, Adam said that he likes Two Dog. He wants to talk about Two Dog. And this brings up something that I was thinking about while I was sitting in the coffee shop reading recently. Because if you know anything about the Searcy Institute office, there's no reading actually happens there because there's too many people talking. So I had to go to the coffee shop to get any reading done, where there was, again, more talking happening. And as I was reading, I was thinking about the sort of the difference, the different kind of scenes that keep popping up in this book. I mentioned last week how it's a little bit episodic, I think was the word that I used, kind of in the same way that Little House on the Prairie is, sort of. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about how there are scenes that are very dramatic. You know, he goes off in the woods and goes up into the mountains and hears the wolf howling, and he goes to Two Dog and there's danger involved and things like that. And then there's these scenes where he's just sort of haying. And, you know, it's this balance between the adventure that is, you know, exploring or going off on some sort of journey that's very necessary, trying to solve some problem. And then there's just the adventure that is life going on. And I was wondering if you found it to be disorienting at all, going back and forth between them, because I was really wanting multiple chapters of this Two Dog thing.
Oh, I see.
Because you said you like him, and I like him too. I like that whole scene, and it felt like, oh, I'll wait. This whole, that was it. It's just one chapter. It's just 10 pages of him going up in the woods and facing his greatest fears and finding them, and then all of a sudden the horse is well again, and then we just get to go back to going to auctions. So, yeah. Adam, so as someone who likes Two Dog and likes those scenes, do you find it disorienting, I guess, is what I'm asking. And I'm not asking this in a way that we should be critical. I'm not asking us to be critical of Ralph Moody. I'm just, from a storytelling perspective, I'm curious.
Well, the thing I liked about the chapter that where he goes after Two Dog and in search of help for his horse is that
chapter 12, if for people who are.
Yeah, chapter 12. The sense of danger that you mentioned is palpable.
And also
the sense, that super high stakes adventure, and also his foolishness and naivete and ignorance of those stakes and of the risks that he's taking, make it a delicious chapter in terms of tension and in terms of the unknown, the anxiety that comes with the unknown. But the resolution that happens when he finally makes it into Two Dog's camp is really poignant, and I think really effective. And this is one of the reasons that I like these characters, not just Two Dog, but also, what's he called? Horse Thief Thompson that he lives with.
Yeah.
We have a picture of them. The last word we have from Mrs. Corcoran is that they're good for nothing thieves and not to be trusted. And we don't necessarily put a lot of stock in what Mrs. Corcoran says, but there's an uncertainty at the back of our minds.
Yeah.
When young Ralph goes up into the middle of the mountains at night in search of these two people. Yeah. And so the tension of the situation and the fact that he's lost in the mountains and there's the wolf howling is compounded by the fact that who he's looking for is two people that we're not really sure he can trust. And so that tension reaches a fever pitch. And then when he shows up in the doorway, the first thing that Horse Thief Thompson says is, do your parents know you're here? He says no. And then immediately they saddle up a horse to take him home. Breaking that tension in a really poignant way, it's obvious to the reader instantly that these are two grown-up adult men that are going to look out for him because he's a boy.
Yeah.
And so all of that unknown, all of that anxiety, all of that tension between us and them, you know, the strangers, the Indian, the loner, whether they're safe or not, all of the anxiety of the unknown that goes into that situation is broken and disappears immediately. And that's why I think that the resolution of this chapter happens so quickly, because it underscores the idea that all of that tension evaporates in a moment. And it's really dramatic and really pleasing that the next thing you know, he wakes up in the morning and the horse is happily munching alfalfa, having been healed by the magic of two dogs. And I think it's episodic. It fits into an episodic story, but it underscores some of the things that all the other chapters underscore, I think, maybe just in a different way, which is that there's an anxiety involved in being young and growing up and not knowing what the future holds and not knowing about the world around you. And that anxiety is going to dissipate as the process of growing up happens. And so this chapter is kind of a dramatic microcosm of what's going on in the story as a whole, I think.
And then you're going to have kids and then the anxiety is going to come back.
Yeah.
Hey, I like that you mentioned that they were adults, you know, two grown men adults, because two grown up adults, I think is what you said, because I was thinking about how it's so obvious by the end of the chapter that he's a kid. He can't even stay awake for the ride home. And then he's passed on from one person to the next. You know, he's hugging his mom's shoulder and then his dad's there and his dad kisses him. So all of, you know, it's clear that he's 9 years old or 8 years old or whatever he is.
Yeah.
He thinks he's a grown up as he's on his way there trying to solve the problem. But, you know, by the end of the chapter, he's sort of just accepted that he's not.
Such a beautiful combination in little Ralph of incipient manhood, you know, that he's trying to become a grown up and then just naive childhood. He does a really nice job, the author does, of giving us both sides of really what is the beauty of a boy, right? That's kind of the beauty of boyhood, is the willingness to get on a horse and go up in the mountains in the middle of the night and fall asleep in somebody's lap on the way home.
Right. Mm. I agree with all of that. I really like that phrase that you use, the anxiety of the unknown. And we've discussed before how much of this book is fictionalized, right? And I kind of don't care that much. But I love this chapter because there's so many aspects of really good storytelling in it. Whether or not it's something that truly happened in his childhood, it doesn't really matter. This is great storytelling. This idea that we've talked about before of kind of the unifying of several different narrative threads and genre threads and form threads. You've got like the going west into the mountains, the pioneering aspect, as well as you know, you pointed out, Andrew, it's not necessarily a coming of age tale because he's not there yet, but it is definitely a childhood narrative of this young man on his journey to becoming a man. Yeah. And learning all the things that he needs to know in terms of knowledge and skills and actions and character in order to become a man. And then also there's, and that's very clear here in this little episode. And then also along with that, this kind of general, I think, commentary on the society, that after all, in spite of all the dangers, the horse carried him into the land and this new society that can be trusted, right? Mm-hmm. That there's something good about it. It's not all just danger as his mother is afraid of, that these men, these grown-ups are good. They took care of him in spite of the fact that it's an Indian who would have been looked upon with suspicion simply because of that and a horse thief. They're still taking care of this young man and returning him home in the harsh land. Exactly, right? The question mark, horsey. I don't want to slander him. We don't know the whole story about him yet. But there's still this integration of society element to this little episode that I think would be easy to overlook, but it's pretty important.
Adam, go ahead.
No, I was just nodding in agreement.
Okay. Well, and also last thing is
Heidi wants to disagree with herself.
No, I didn't. is I loved what Adam, I think it was Adam last week, brought up the orphan element, how this isn't an orphan tale. Mm-hmm. And yet every good childhood story has to have at least one orphan episode, right? That's my kids play orphan all the time. Well, my son is 12, so he doesn't really play anymore, but my daughter still, she's 10 and right in the middle of everything that they play, they're orphans. Mm-hmm. Because orphans have possibilities, right? They don't have boundaries. They don't have anyone mm-hmm. telling them no.
Yeah.
So they can go out into the dangerous world and make their own way. And so any good childhood story has to have at least one episode in which the child is thrown out into the scary world all alone and must either be rescued by somebody trustworthy or learn to rise to the occasion. And this little episode has both of those things.
Mm. Yeah, I mentioned last week that my friend Josh says that orphans are free to have adventures.
Yes.
That's why there's so many.
That was you that brought that up, David. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't know if it was. I don't know if it was.
Yeah.
This book is I really have been enjoying it, going through it again. It reminds me this issue of little boys striking off into the wilderness and having mm-hmm. adventure, and what and how that's kind of an orphan effect. It reminds me of a book I read when my kids were little called Bud and Me, The True Adventures of the Abernathy Boys. Have you guys heard of that book?
Never heard of it.
I don't think
Tell
so.
Us more.
It is it's a story by a woman called Alta Abernathy, who tells the story of her husband and his brother when they were young.
Huh.
And it happened in 1909, between 1909 and 1913. They were 5 years old and 9 years old, respectively.
Wow.
And their father put them on a horse and sent them off on a cross-country trip.
No.
Alone. Holy and they...
I'm like having an anxiety attack right now.
Rode across the country on a horse, 5-year-old and a 9-year-old, alone.
Good heavens.
This woman, they're both dead by the time she writes this. I think she wrote it in the... She wrote it in the...
They're both dead by the time the book ends, you mean?
No. No, basically, one of their wives grew old and looked back on this amazing experience that her husband had and wrote a book about it. And it became really famous. I mean, it's written at a grade school, junior high level, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, the most astonishing thing about it is that in this world of 1909, this was a thing that a father contemplated and actually put in motion. And they tell amazing stories about, in particular, how strangers would take care of them.
Huh.
Strangers would see their situation and ask what they were doing. And this is who my parents are and this is where we're going. And we're expected, at this place at such and such a time. And strangers over and over again would take care of them and make sure they were fed and send them on their way. And in one instance, even, they were taken care of by horse thieves. Like, bad guys on the run from the law crossed their paths, took care of them, saw that they were fed and dressed and bathed and sent them on their way, and then proceeded to continue in their lawless deeds.
There's a code.
There's a code, right? You go among horse thieves. Anyway, Bud and Me, The Adventures of the Abernathy Boys, I highly recommend it. But it reminds me of this story in the issue that we're talking about, that I think that we tend to think the orphan is free to have adventures. Maybe that's a feature of this day and age where we keep closer tabs on our children, right? Maybe back in Ralph Moody's day, everybody had adventures, and that makes me think that this chapter about Two Dog is maybe more factual than fanciful.
Wow.
My wife and I were talking recently about what kind of things to let the boys do, and long story, but basically we got to talking about how when I was eight or nine, we moved from Wisconsin to Idaho. And we had some friends whose dad was a truck driver. And he came through, he had this route where he would go, he'd get something from Wisconsin and take it to Washington State and then to pick up something in Washington State. I think it was cherries and apples, and he'd go back and forth. So he's going up through the Dakotas and Wyoming and Montana and northern Idaho and so forth. And he came down to Boise and picked us up. And me and my brother were 9 and 8 or 8 and 7 or something like that. And he had a couple of kids, and my parents just put us on that 18-wheeler with the big cab with him, And we spent 10 days in that cab riding across the top, you know, riding across the northern parts of the country.
Wow. It
took us 10 days to get from Boise to Green Bay, partly because he had to stop a couple of places and the shipments weren't ready. So he's, you know, I just remember he'd drive all night, and during the day we'd stop for a few hours at some truck stop, and we would just get out and play in the truck stop, you know, and then we'd talk to truckers and he'd be sleeping. And I was thinking, we were talking about how this is the mid 90s, I guess, but in 2019, my oldest is only a year or two away from how old I was then.
Right.
I'm trying to imagine
no way in the world, right?
Yeah. Even with somebody that I knew, it's a different world. Even 20 years ago or however many years ago, I mean,
yeah.
25 years ago. And let alone put them on a horse by themselves. I mean, they would fall off the horse, of course, but you know,
I know.
If they knew how to ride a horse. And that's, you know, that the horse thing is interesting to me that they would do that, because even here we, you know, this book, there's so much in this book about the relationship between the boy and the horse,
right.
Which is not, that's a common thing in lots of literature. The horse and his boy obviously comes to mind, but mm-hmm. There has to be this like symbiotic relationship, because the boy can't control the horse. You know, a right. man maybe can manhandle, well, maybe not totally manhandle a horse, but is strong enough to make the horse go where it wants it to go. But the horse and the boy have to have a relationship
mutual
where the horse,
trust.
Yeah, the horse has right. to trust and respect the boy in order to allow him to say, yeah, we're going here. And then the
right.
boy has to trust the horse that it's going to take him where he needs to go. And I was struck when reading this chapter that his adventure begins to flip. It begins to work out at that moment where he says, you know, he's heard the howling, mm-hmm. and he starts to think about his father and his mother and the rest of the youngsters at home. And he says, I wanted to turn Fanny and race out of the canyon as fast as she could go. But when I looked down into the gorge, it was as black as a well. Though I'd never heard a wolf's howl before, I had read about it and knew what I must have heard. Goes on. And then it says, that settled it. I kicked my heels into Fanny's ribs and tried to cluck to her, but my mouth was so dry that I only made a hissing sound. I think that was the first time Fanny ever trusted my judgment more than her own.
Huh.
She gathered her muscles and tore up the rest of the grade as though the wolf had her by the tail. We came onto the flat rock. And then right after that, he comes out of the clearing and then he yells for them and they come out. So I was struck by that moment. There seems to be a moment there that happens between them when they're both afraid. And they both, the horse and the boy, decide to trust one another. Mm. And at that moment, the adventure starts to turn. And I don't know if he's, you know, Ralph Moody's trying to do that purposefully. It might have just been the way it really happened. But
yeah.
the symbiosis or whatever you want to say there that happens is fascinating.
That's true.
I have another question.
I thought it was interesting in the chapters that we're talking about today, the instances of fighting that come up.
Mm. Huh.
There's a fight in the chapter on haying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That
between the men.
The men, and it sets the stage for another fight in the chapter 13 or 14, the irrigation fight.
Yeah.
Right.
That it put me in mind of that's something that I wanted to discuss with you guys and see what you thought of it. You remember in the haying chapter, there's a fight because one of the hired hands that's from Denver has been hired into the neighborhood and is sort of a stranger on the scene, makes some sort of crude comment about one of the women that's there. And Ralph doesn't tell us what the comment is, but we can infer from the details, some crude sexual comment. And then he's challenged to a fight by one of the woman's friends, I think, or one of the people in the neighborhood. And I thought it was interesting that everybody gathers around and presumably to make sure the fight is civil or something, make sure they follow the rules or something like that. But nobody, he says several times that nobody stops the fight.
Yeah.
Almost as if to say a fist fight is an appropriate way to handle this. Did you guys get the sense that he was saying that?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and then at the end of it, he pays off the guy who was running the operation, pays off the Denver guys, and they leave. Yeah. And it's just kind of the end of it, you know?
Right.
He's like,
so first of all, we're going to lick you. And secondly, you're done here. We're going to pay you off and send you home.
Right. There's like a code of honor around it, right? You don't stop the fight. You don't step in and break it up. You let it happen, but it's clear when it's over. And then there's this kind of set way of handling it. So
yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a proper response when someone says something like that.
Right.
Is that one of the reasons that that we like this book? I mean, is the fact that it's got that sort of code sort of written into it that make it attractive?
Well, I was going to ask why this book is so beloved. That was one of my questions I had.
Yeah, written down, so. That's got to be some of it, right? That this it's almost looking at the Western ethos through the eyes of an outsider, this child. I remember something that J.K. Rowling said about Harry Potter when she wrote the first book was, I had to write the book as if Harry was a vessel for this strange new world. Right. Mm. So in the first couple of books, specifically in the first book in that series, Harry is a lot more passive than he is in the later books when he's a fully integrated member of that community. But so much of looking into the wizarding society is through the eyes of an outsider. And we can, as the reader, can feel like we're behind those eyes. And then we feel like we're becoming integrated in through Harry as our vessel, right? And I think in some ways, that's what's happening here. Hmm. He's a young boy who's brought into this new society of which he has to become a functioning member worthy of a man's world. And we get to experience that integration along with him. So I think that is a lot of the appeal of something like this, as well as just that's attractive, you know, the American, as we pointed out, just that's part of the American history and we want to feel like we're part of that.
Mm. I just realized I was just struck by the fact that we've been talking a lot about the colliding of civilization in the wilderness, and they're kind of, you know, his mom's trying to bring in the civilization and trying to preserve that in their family. And he's kind of going against that. And I'm struck by the fact that the guys who are the lowbrow guys that cause the problems are actually from the city. And it's the people in the area, these few guys who, like, this is their community. They have the code. Like, they handle it in the way you have to handle it there. But it's the city that brings in the problem in this particular.
That's interesting.
Well, yeah.
With Denver.
Yeah, that happens all the time. We're always judging people from Denver out here.
that fight scene in the chapter on haying. I said a minute ago, I think it sort of set the stage for the next fight, the fight that happens later in the chapter on irrigation.
Yeah.
And
14, chapter 14.
Yeah, chapter 14. When if I'm remembering all the details right, the guys in the neighborhood are they're getting their water stolen by people higher up the creek, right? Whose farms the water runs by first, and it's a dry spell, and the people first in line are taking more than their share. Mm-hmm. And Ralph's father, who is this paragon of fatherly virtue, goes to Fred Altland and said, what are we going to do about this? Let's figure out how we could settle this in the court and bring suit and everything. And Fred Altland convinces him, there's no way to do that. That's not going to work. It'll be futile. I think what we've got to do is fight the water through, by which he means punch people in the head
and
steal the water in order to keep the sluice gates open.
He does mean that.
And so then, Ralph Moody's father, who is sick with tuberculosis, starts going out. Am I getting this right? He starts going out every night to participate in all night long fist fights with the bad guys so as to keep the sluice gates open and water his own fields, right?
Occasionally there's a gun involved.
And occasionally there's a gun. And at one point they say, when they're trying to figure out how to solve it, pretty soon someone's going to get killed.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
And they finally handle it.
Once someone's dead, then it's gone too far.
That's it. Once someone's dead, it's gone too far. But there's this unspoken, or even spoken, understanding that up until that point, this might be the best way to handle it.
Right.
And the fact that Ralph's father participates in this, tuberculosis though he is or whatever, sort of lends legitimacy to it. Sometimes you have to punch the bad guy in the head. I think it's really interesting that that's presented that way. And I wondered what your guys' reaction to it was. And it was similar to In the Haying chapter?
Right. Just assumed that that is the way to resolve a conflict.
Yeah.
Right.
And I got to thinking as I was reading it, Fred Altman might be right. I mean, in the end, Father comes up with a solution that everybody, that everybody praises,
yeah.
but not until he has given as good as he's gotten in a series of brawls.
Right.
And it seems like what they're basically saying is they're talking about justice. Like, how do we make sure that justice is served? And ultimately the resolution that he proposes is not the most just resolution.
Right.
Because they're still going to get less than what they were promised. They're getting 80% of what they, you know, they're supposed to be getting. But it's, you know, to get the most justice they can, they have to do it this way. There has to be, you know, there has to be a sort of conflict. And I was struck by the mother in this scenario.
Right.
Because throughout the book, she's been criticizing Charlie, the father, for the things that he lets, you know, lightly criticizing the things that he lets Ralph get involved in.
Right.
And the way that, but then here, she doesn't criticize him for doing the things that he's doing, but she sits nearby. You know, he talks about how she's nervously biting her lip.
Mm-hmm. You know,
and Ralph has noticed that she's crying. But then at the same time, when he's wondering what's going on, she's the one who, you know, she's
like,
don't worry about it. It'll be fine. Yeah. And then in the moment when the men are having all the meeting at the house, I was struck again. The meeting ends when she walks into the room.
Right.
You know, Charlie makes this proposal. Ralph's father makes the proposal, and everyone kind of argues about it just for long enough. And then she enters the room at the right time for that to be the proposal that they go with. So in some ways, she's constantly fighting against. You know, she's trying to fight. She herself is fighting against this way of sort of this, I guess, this sort of Western justice that has to happen because there's no alternative, right?
Right, exactly. There's no recourse.
The courts can't be trusted.
Yeah.
I just think it's interesting that it's portrayed in such a positive light.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's not like the guys that are participating, Charlie convinces them all of his plan and they say, yeah, you're right. That probably will work and it does work. And they're all glad that they don't have to fight the water, you know, down the creek anymore.
Right.
There wasn't anything wrong with that first solution.
Yeah. Nobody is saying this is ridiculous.
Eventually going to get somebody killed, and that's that would be bad. But it's working so far right this minute.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that's...
It is. And as a woman and a mother, I am one of those old-fashioned people who just thinks, wow, guys are really different from girls. So as I'm reading this probably maybe a little differently even than you all are. I'm curious about that. So my first question is, Have either of you ever been in a fight?
Have we ever?
I was in a fight.
Yes, it's like not something that girls do ever. Like I've never in my life ever punched anybody.
I'm sure that's not
true. One time I hit my brother in the face, and my dad spanked me for it.
Well, justice.
That's the only time.
So I assume there are women out there listening that have been in fist fights before.
I'm sure there are.
But Adam, so do you have a fist fight story to tell?
Oh, not really. I punched a kid that was bullying me in junior high once, and he didn't bully me anymore.
Yeah. I mean,
kind of like the Ralph Moody story, to tell you the truth. It wasn't as bloody as all that, but
yeah, David. That kid didn't keep coming. I got brothers, of course.
Right.
Just the other day, in fact. No, yeah. I mean, I was smaller than everybody. I got in fist fights a lot. I mean, I wouldn't say they were like terrible, but you know, not when I was like in high school, but when I was younger, yeah. I can distinctively remember some in high school, actually, now that I think about it.
It was noticeable, remarkable to me that I was, Ralph Moody is setting up his father as a paragon, as an exemplar,
right.
You know, like that. And so I'm sort of thinking about him in Atticus Finch terms by the time we're up to chapter 14. And then he's a brawler, just like everybody else. And I thought that was really... And his reputation doesn't suffer in Ralph's eyes at all, or in ours as readers.
Right.
Or in the community.
Right.
Do you think that that's... I mean, are you... And you say you're kind of saying it like you're surprised. So I guess the question is, do you think that that's, I guess the real question is, would you do that?
Not the real question.
Do you think that that's, from the perspective of from the perspective of the author of Ralph Moody, not the boy Ralph Moody, do you get the sense that he's saying that this was the right approach? I mean, is that kind of?
Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. Because the hero of the story, Ralph's father, was perfectly willing to take that to take that road and to put that particular solution into play, and did what was necessary. Yeah, I think he says at one point, son, sometimes you have to do do stuff you don't want to do in order to take care of your family. So I do think that the perspective of the story is to approve.
Right. Mm. That this is just a part of being, growing up to be a man in a man's world is you learn to defend yourself and what is yours, your family, your property, your rights through violent action if you have to.
Sure. This is one of the reasons though why I was hoping for like a multi-chapter. This story would have been multi-chapter because I think, you know, when you get into him going for Two Dog or this chapter on the irrigation, in particular is something that feels like it had been built up. It had been referenced so many times. We knew it was coming. And then it's the one chapter and it may come back again. But, you know, it's not vigilante justice, but it's certainly, you know, kind of Western justice. It's certainly not justice, you know, the way we think of it. It's certainly not justice through the courts, right? So in some ways, I wish, I don't want to be overly critical, but my instinct is to want to have more consequences, you know, for that to have a better sense of, you know, what does it mean that these guys did that? I mean, maybe this isn't the novel for it, of course, but.
Well, I think, I mean, I don't want to be a spoiler alert, but the issue is going to come up again. So there was a little hint of it in the first couple of chapters, and then it breaks out into the open here in chapter 14, and it's not settled yet. So he's there's an arc to this irrigation story that's really, I think, one of the cool underlying themes of the novel.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think that what you're saying, David, is valid in the sense of why not kind of a chunk that explores like multiple chapters in a row that explore one thing and then tying some of the threads in. And this does feel more episodic. And I'm wondering if part of that is because that's how our childhood memories are. You know, when we look back, we remember, you know, more in the nature of episodes rather than, you know, a unified narrative thread in the development of something.
Yeah, our childhood memories don't work like within a rigorously cultivated narrative structure.
Right. And the way our adult memories do. Like I remember kind of, I do remember narrative threads as an adult more than I do as a child. Like I think about the years the years when my kids were very little, the years as newlyweds, right? The years when I worked at such and such a job.
We marked the occasion, yeah.
Right. Whereas my childhood memories are more like, you know,
I did this time and this that time.
Yeah, and then this, and then of course there is the narrative thread, but I remember it more in fragments than I do my adult seasons. Hmm.
There is a structure to that, though. I mean, I'm thinking of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a form of childhood recollection.
And yeah, that's
true. Very episodic, especially at first. Each chapter is a new topic, a new subject, a new vignette or a new scene. But then every once in a while, the issues that are going to form the stirring climax of the story get kind of dropped in occasionally. And the frequency of those mentions or those occurrences of the big events starts to increase until in the end, the whole story is about the real crisis. I mean, that's a cool structure. That's a cool structure for a story and a novel. And I sort of see Ralph Moody doing that here in the middle chapters of this one.
Right.
Do you think that, I guess we could go over a lot of different coming of age novels, but do you think that that's something that is true of most of the best coming of age novels, because those topics or whatever in those early chapters not only allow you to set the stage for the scene or get to know the character, set the stage for the whole novel's conflict and get to know the characters, but they also allow you to cover the various... Now, this isn't the right word, but it's the one that pops into my head right now, the various lessons that children and young people are learning as they're kind of going through their coming of age.
Sure.
While, you know, being able to wrap it all up later. Is like a building's roman, for example, does it necessitated, like, does that necessitate that kind of form to do it right?
I don't know if I'd go that far, because I can think of coming of age stories that aren't quite as episodic as that. Like Great Expectations, for example, is way more coherent, and it's kind of a blow by blow account of a single narrative arc. Mm-hmm. But I certainly think that the episodic style does what you just said, and it has strengths there to set the stage for character development and that kind of thing. I definitely think it's an appropriate style for a Bildungsroman.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Did you want to add something there, Heidi?
No, I think that's well said. Good job, Adam.
Well, Adam got in something smart, so I guess we're done for the day.
Heck, I'm done for the week.
Well, it is Friday. Okay. So we have, let's see, we've got this irrigation fight, and then I give Mr. Lake a ride where he puts the burr on the saddle of the man at the school. And one of the things I love about coming of age stories pre-1950 is the way they treat education. So you look at schooling in Little House on the Prairie, schooling in Farmer Boy, schooling in Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, and schooling here. Like, there's this sort of, I don't want to say disdain, but there is definitely an ambivalence about...
Yeah, I think disdain is appropriate.
So the guy that the head of the school board, he comes out, he's kind of a jerk. He's kind of mean to the teacher. The students, I do love that all the students stand up for their teacher, including Grace. She has to then stand in the corner for a while. And Ralph goes out and puts the burr under the saddle. And when he sits on the saddle, the donkey kicks him off. And is this just another example of that sort of conflict between civilization and, I don't know, on the other side, but the West sort of coming into conflict with each other?
The pioneering spirit.
Yeah, the not being tenable. I mean, we keep getting these two things running into each other, whether it's justice and the, you know, Western cowboy justice, we'll call it, and the courts, whether it's the way that, you know, the way his mom wants him to dress and the necessity for overalls, whether it's schooling and you know, the board member coming in, all these different things keep coming in contact with each other. They keep clashing here in this town on their, you know, whatever the town is called. So is that the point, though, that these things cannot coexist together? One time after another, we find them not coexisting. Go ahead, Adam.
You're talking about, in this case, education and the civilization that they're living in?
I guess I don't mean it to be that specific. I mean, my point is just that we keep having this recurring theme of civilization and wilderness coming in conflict with each other. And the ability to coexist within both of them is very fraught. You know, I know you can't have wilderness and civilization operating at peak wilderness and peak civilization at the same time in the same place. But it's very fraught, the experience that they're all having within that. And does it feel like, is the idea that you have to choose one or the other?
I don't know. Well, that's interesting. Go ahead, Heidi. No.
Well, I think some of it, and this may be I may be imposing my own value of education upon this, but I think some of it is the inadequacy of the old way to encounter the particular challenges of a particular place.
The old way of what? Sorry, just to clarify.
Of educating. Mm. Yeah. That kind of sit in a schoolhouse, learn stuff you're never going to use on the ranch. You know, that why is any book learning necessary here? All I really need to know is how to ride my horse. And clearly this is, you know, this education is going to fall off the back of the horse. Right. So I think some of it I look at as, you know, less an indictment of education itself, because I think of the tenderness in the way he speaks of his mother's reading. So it is so clear that he loved that experience as a child and that he paid attention to it when she, and like that's the way he speaks about that experience of his mother reading to their family is just really sweet and precious and clearly something he valued. But at the same time, he's lured away from that by the horse. So he intentionally leaves that experience to go ride. So maybe
that's kind of what I'm getting at. It seems like the
wilderness is winning his heart, at least.
Yeah. There's this the wilderness is calling, right?
Yeah.
And
I must go. Yeah.
I mean, I think we all feel that too, right? There's times when it feels like, you know, where we love two things, right? Like, right. You know, I thought about this was a big thing for me when I was in school because I was playing sports and I was hanging out. I was on playing football and basketball and I was in that world. But then I also loved literature and poetry and movies and was in theater, right. And like loved both of those two things. And was sort of like, I felt it, how you coexist in two different worlds is a very, you know, universal human, challenging thing, you know, and especially for young people, I think, as you're trying to figure out which world do I most belong in. So does he most, he's probably feeling that pull, like, do I belong in the world of that my mom loves, you know, the world, right, of the poetry and the nice suits and, you know, or do I belong in the world of, you know, dust and corrals and, you know.
That's an interesting feature in American history of a civilization that is pushing out its frontier. There's always, at every point in, well, especially in the 19th century in America, there's always a foundation back east where cultural, social, educational institutions are established and functioning and doing the things that they can do because of the leisure that is afforded by an relatively advanced civilization. Right. But that civilization is pushing west all the time in the 19th century and pushing out its frontier. Yeah. And so the vanguard of that civilization is out in the sticks. And they come from the east, and so they have the cultural institutional assumptions of the east in their back pockets, so to speak. And their instinct is to try and set them up here. In fact, the whole purpose of the enterprise is to try and set those institutions up in the West, out at the frontier.
Right.
But there's always a gap, there's a lag between the level of development that they assume from back East and the level of development that's possible in essentially a subsistence type culture, which is what the frontier always is. And that's probably a source of a lot of that tension. We're talking about farmers and ranchers who need their children to get on with the haying and can't afford them. Can't afford for them yet anyway to be sitting in school learning from books. That's a generation down the road maybe.
And it's ironic too, because we're a country who our mythology is that wilderness, right? So as we grow and become more of a country and the civilization moves further west, we're like clinging to this mythology of the West that we're pushing out. Like the more we were clinging to that mythology, the more we were pushing it away. Even think of like as the railroad goes, the railroad's going, bringing civilization. And at the same time, you know, it's the buffalo thing. The hunters are on the train that's bringing civilization east, and they're destroying the things that they talk about in all their tales, right? And that made us, that kind of created the American spirit. We talk about the American spirit, and the American spirit is both loving the wilderness and getting rid of it at the same time. It's kind of it's almost incoherent in some ways.
Yep. Right.
Maybe ironic is enough of a word. I don't know.
Yeah. I think there's definitely an irony for sure.
Right. A tragic one in a lot of cases, but that isn't really explored in this novel necessarily. Mm-mm. So far, at least.
At least not yet.
Right.
It does take me back, though, to what I think I said this in the first episode, that Colorado is at that point, it's at such a key point in the trajectory of the evolution of the West, because it's not, you're not all the way, you're not over the Rockies yet, but you know, you're also not in the East anymore. And so it's, you know, it's appropriate that I think the story takes place, a story like this takes place there.
Right. Well, and Colorado is a very dramatic landscape, even visually. It's harsh. So we live right? We live in the forest that's between the mountains and the prairie. So if you look east, it's flat, like as far as you can see. And if you look west, it's just mountains. And I think all the time of what that must have been like to come from the east and then encounter this ridge of impossible mountains. Yeah. And they're just yeah. so beautiful. But I mean, even driving over them is treacherous. I'm imagining, you know, that's like where the Dahmer party died. Like it's a very dramatic place. And to come to the base of that, like, and live there. I mean, we use the word liminal. It is a very liminal existence because you're still out in the wilderness, but there's this ridge of mountains that is kind of the entrance of discovery, of manifest destiny. So there, you've kind of reached as far as you can go unless you're willing to risk your life. Mm-hmm. So that is, I think, in the idea of the things matter, like incarnations of things matter. Like that's, I'm imagining what it would have been like to live at the base of the Rockies in that time in history, in which you can't go back to the east, and yet you can't really go forward west without kind of taking your life in your hands, and you're trying to build yeah. a society there. That's shaping to the psychological ethos of the place.
I remember as a kid driving from Idaho to Wisconsin and going through all these mountain ranges out there, and how you get to the bottom of them and you just start climbing, or as you see them in the distance and you get closer and closer, it really does feel like there needs to be swelling music.
Yeah.
You know, like it feels like you're about, even in a car in 1999 or whatever it was, even in a car then with air conditioning and radio and all that, you were doing something dramatic. You were taking some sort of a risk in your hands. And I remember driving over, even now, driving, and it feels like you're looking down, you know, thousands and thousands of feet. So I can't right. imagine it being 1888 or whatever, trying to get out to where Adam lives.
Yeah, you have to, if you leave Heidi's house and go west, there's nothing but mountains between her house and mine.
Yeah.
That's right. It's just one long, you know, death defying trip.
Good thing we got airplanes, huh?
And cars. Reason people go to the mountains is to ski. I think that's funny too. Like, yeah. you know, we go to cabins or we go skiing or whatever. It's not the same anymore. And that's less, you know, that's just 100 years ago, which isn't really very long.
No, it's not. It's not.
Yeah. Anyway, Adam, you were going to say something.
I was going to say that this question of that you're sort of alluding to, of whether or not you can survive and whether you can make it and whether you can establish a civilization or a community or a home, it's part of the American Western
right.
experience. Mm-hmm. And that's the underlying question of all settlers and all pushers west, right? And right. I think that we do well to dwell on that theme in discussing this book, because really it's the underlying question of Little Britches is right. whether or not we're going to make it. Can we make it stick? Can we stick here? Right.
Right. Which goes then to David's question about education. Right. And that, I think, is maybe everything about the modern utilitarian approach, at least in America, has got to be influenced by this Western ethos, right? This idea that, like, really, 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 truly, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but really, what can a country schoolhouse teach me that, like, isn't it really more useful for me to learn haying and riding horses and fixing covered wagon wheels and planting?
Surviving.
Right? Like, honestly, in terms of what is required in order to, as Adam puts it, to make it here, then is education in a country schoolhouse, when I'm learning the times tables, is that equal to the task of what is before me in building this nation, and then on the personal level, building my family, right? That's actually a real question, a lot different than it is now. It's different.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. Since we don't live in a frontier society anymore.
Right.
It makes me, so my immediate thought to that is probably it's not as valuable, but then there is still the question that his mom is consumed with. That, you know, what's it going to, you know, maybe right now it helps me survive. Maybe just the kind of knowledge that you were talking about there helps Horse Thief Thompson survivor, these men who are fighting for their water. Maybe it helps that generation survive. But if you want to have a real place that's going to last, that you can preserve, then you do need some of those things if you're going to actually create a, you know, a civilization that's going to be there for longer than, you know, one generation, until they go on, until people there move on and go find the next thing.
Right. But, because surviving and the good life are two different things, just basic survival versus living in a society worth living in. Two different questions.
Well, and what you're talking about here, it brings me to the very end of what we read for this week, at the end of that chapter, A Good Month with No School. And I actually think I'd like to read this because I think there's a lot of pathos in this. Adam, could you read the last three chapters of that chapter for us?
The last three paragraphs, you mean?
Last three paragraphs. What did I say?
You said chapters.
The last three paragraphs of A Good Month with No School. So starting with, we scooped out a hole.
Oh, sure. We scooped out a hole nearly as big as our kitchen. While Father dug the corners out square with a pick and shovel, I peeled bark off the poles with his draw knife. It took 5 days to build the cellar. After the hole was dug, we cribbed the walls up with poles like a log house. We made the end walls half round at the tops and then laid poles across to make the roof. Grace and I stuffed all the cracks on the outsides of the walls and roof with straw while Father made the door and the steps. Then we hitched up the horses and, with the scraper at the end of a long rope, filled dirt in tight around the sides and over the roof till it looked like a little hill with a trap door in it. The next week I peeled poles while Father built them into a corral. It was a good one, with a 6-pole fence 5 feet high. Father set a big high post for the gate to swing on. Then he made the gate out of slim poles with the butt ends toward the hinges and a guy wire running from the top of the post to the lighter end of the gate so it could never sag. While we were building it, I got thinking how lonesome our little house had looked to me sitting out there on the prairie when I'd first seen it from the hill by Fort Logan. When the last nail was driven and the hasp was put on the gate, I got Father to let me put Nig and the new colt and our two cows in the corral. Then he let me take Fanny and ride up to that hill again so I could look at our place and see how much it looked like a real ranch now.
I really like this because in some ways, the matter of perspective, I mean, his use of this child's perspective is really nice because, you know, the child, bit by bit through the story, is taking so much pride in things that they're doing. You know, whether it's he gets to work with his father and then he gets his money included in the check, you know. But here he gets to go up, he gets to ride up to the hill and see what they're building, to see that, you know, they started with, and to realize that what they're doing is making, I'm going to say this is a cliche, but making a difference. You know, the work that they're doing is actually building something. And even at 9 years old or whatever it is, he's beginning to, you know, he's beginning to see the fruits of their labor, you know. And I think that's as much as days they've endured, and, you know, those moments, especially for children, for all of us, are so profound, and they're things that keep us going, right? When we can look and see that the work that we've been doing is meaningful, whether to somebody else or in terms of just surviving.
Right.
Yeah. And also, it's a step in the direction of answering the question, are they going to make it? Mm-hmm. Are they going to stick? When you dig a cellar and you put a more or less permanent structure up, then maybe that's heading towards a yes answer.
Right.
And I love how that doesn't really answer the question completely yet, but it's an element of the rising action of this story. It looks like they might gonna make it. We'll see about the water. We'll see about the other stuff.
Well, in the paragraph before what you read, Adam, you see how much Ralph is actually contributing to that, right? Can I read that?
Yeah.
Father explained to me before we started, and I was so afraid I might do something wrong and get him badly hurt that my hands were shaking when I reached out to take the lines. He wouldn't let me take hold of them then. He said I'd have to stop a little while and get my mind straightened out because a horse could tell through the feel of the reins if the person driving him was afraid. Then he told me I had already proved I could make a horse do what I wanted it to, so there was no reason to be afraid now. It made me proud to hear him say that. And when I reached out for the lines again, my hands were steady. I wrapped the reins around them and called, "Get up," with my voice as deep in my throat as I could make it go.
That's cute.
That's like a formative moment, right? When you're a child, a little boy, and you realize, I can do this thing. And it's not, it's actually something real that matters to what my family is building and who my dad is telling me that I can be. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal.
And it takes us back to the earlier moment, right? When he has that moment with the horse.
Right.
His dad points out to him, you already have a relationship with these horses. You're already a pretty good horseman.
Right.
Trust what you know, trust yourself, trust what you're doing, trust the horse, and you'll be okay. And the father basically, you know, says, I'm putting my safety in your hands, because it says, you know, there that right before that, that if he doesn't do what he's supposed to do,
right,
they could run him over or whatever. So right. Even the father there is trusting him. And so not only do the boy and the horse have this moment where they trust each other, but the father is saying, I trust you. You know, I trust you with my life right now, with my health.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's so important. And Adam, you mentioned earlier that you're glad we live at a time with modern conveniences and don't live during this time. I heartily agree with that. I just think sometimes I read about these pioneer women, and forgive me, mothers who want to do this with your life. Like, I literally feel like Ma in Little House on the Prairie's life is a living hell. So I'm so glad. But I also look at this and I vividly remember when I was first homeschooling my kids, and my friend Emily said to me that she realized that she didn't need her kids for anything. And that's like haunted me ever since she said that years ago. The idea that we don't need our children, but there was a time in our history when people had lots of kids because they literally needed them to do work. Like here, right? They need Ralph. He must contribute to this family in order for it to become a ranch. And so, and I don't need my kids for the chore, like for our survival as a family. And so back in this time, I think that's part of why this book is so beloved. This idea of a family drawing together to do something real in the world and to build something that it isn't that this young man is becoming a man because his parents want him to. It's because he has to. He must. Mm-hmm. In order for them to do, as you said, can we make it? Yes, we can, if Ralph will actually help.
Right.
That's something new in our history, that the generations recent, in which, you know, we don't need them to do stuff around the house and around our property and for our land and all that. And so I don't know. I look at this and I think that's part of why this book is so beloved, and why people keep reading these pioneering stories from our history, is we want to reconnect with that idea.
Yeah, I think that I'm fascinated by that idea that in creating civilization over the last 100 years, we've made our children
almost obsolete, right? They don't matter until they're old enough to get jobs.
But this is like the first...
That's so sad.
The first civilization in history, right?
Yes. Even,
it wasn't like in Florence in the Renaissance times when there was civilization, their kids were unnecessary.
Right.
So...
Right.
I don't think I've ever thought about that before. I've thought in terms of like, it's important to give our kids things that make them feel
right.
Like they're doing
something. Like we have to make them feel important. Like I have to make my kids like, well, I better teach Lucy how to do the dishes so she feels like she's contributing, right? Like so, but...
Yeah, or it's more like, I mean, there is some value in just like making them learn to do things so that they become self-sufficient, honorable, right. You know, good people. But that's kind of a different question.
Right.
Here's an idea that'll blow all your minds. Work is a curse.
Yeah.
Work is the curse. So we should all dearly hope to live in a civilization someday where nobody has to work. This would be great.
Now tell me what that has to do with what we're saying.
Yeah.
Well, what we're saying is, isn't it sad that our kids aren't slaving away on a farm somewhere. I would say, no, that's not sad. That's happy. Or at least,
yeah.
Or at least suggest it. That the
no.
the need to work like Ralph has to do is a function of his society and his civilization not being established yet.
So, but hold on, work is a curse. I don't know when God. So when God,
that sounds like something somebody says very strongly in a very specific way just to get a specific response.
Right. I agree. So. But when God put Adam in the garden before the curse, before the fall, he says, I put the man in the garden to work it and to care for it. But the curse says that the ground is cursed because the land is cursed. And the curse is that man will, this is to your point, that man will be forced to work in some ways for nothing, to toil. Hold on, I'm trying to think of the exact word. Do you remember from Genesis 2? I'm looking it up right now.
Toil is the curse.
Yes.
So hard work is a curse. I love this philosophy of life I'm propounding right now.
I know. As I sit
in my soft chair.
Yeah, yeah.
God bless. 7 day to... He put the man whom he had formed and out of the ground. There he put the man whom he had formed to work it and to care for it. So work is not the curse. As you said, Adam, toil is the curse.
What do you mean?
There's certainly toil in this
book. The fact that Ralph learns great lessons and has great experiences while working and doing something besides reading about ideas, for example, doesn't mean that those things are better.
Sure. Okay.
About ideas.
But wouldn't you say, in this fake argument that you're making, that I brought this last chapter up because it's this last paragraph up because it's showing the effect in his personhood of the work. It's not just that he is learning these great lessons, but it's cultivating in him, you know, he's building self-esteem. Through this work, he's becoming more human. So on the one hand, yes, it's a curse that he has to do all this kind of thing. And it doesn't make, I wouldn't suggest that his work is perhaps inherently better or worse than the work that comes with you sitting around all day reading books or whatever, or me, or whatever. But both of those jobs, both of those work, both of those activities can cultivate more humanness in people, even as it's maybe not desirable to do them, right?
I'm not sure I understand. Say it one more time.
I don't know if I know what I'm talking about. I guess I'm trying to, but of course I might be trying to respond to something. I don't know what you're saying, but you know, there's the value. You mentioned that he's learning all these lessons, but it's more than he's learning lessons. He's becoming more human through the work. So I don't know that the book is inherently saying that ranch work is inherently better than studious work. Would you say that do you think that's what the book is saying?
I don't.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I think what he's talking about is the things he learned about being a man through his experiences. But the fact that his experiences, and we were all talking about the fact that his experiences are much different than the experiences of modern children.
Yeah, right.
Right.
What I would say is that the fact that those experiences are different isn't necessarily to say that one is better than the other.
Right.
Because one of the reasons he had to work so hard is that the civilization he was trying to establish hadn't been established yet.
Right.
And this isn't a good thing. It's not necessarily a good thing. Might even be a bad thing. Maybe it's better to have your civilization established already, or at least there's good and bad to both, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So absolutely. You're saying don't romanticize the wilderness.
Exactly. I think we and in a book that's as well written as this one, and that's as pleasant and that scratches all of the itches that we have about, you know, about family and about responsibility and about character and all that stuff. A book that presents those things as eloquently as this one does, I think we potentially run a risk of romanticizing the period in which it came.
Well, I think
the period from which it came.
Sorry.
That's all.
Well, I think that's why this book, that's why it's important that this book is at the intersection of the vast wilderness and the civilization behind it. It's about it's about those two things clashing and figuring out how do you coexist at that gap where the civilization is not established, but the wilderness is not taking, it's not as wild as it was. You know, so you have questions of justice arising, whereas in a pure wilderness, questions of justice aren't relevant. Or at least they're very different. You have questions of education. You know, those questions are very different in a pure wilderness. And so it's the intersection of those two things. And it's about how does civilization get carved out? Yeah, maybe it is better to have your civilization be already, you know, created. But it's not judging, it's not saying that civilization is bad inherently, and it's not saying that the wilderness is bad, but it's what happens when those two things collide and when there's people stuck in that place where they do collide.
Right. Right.
Go ahead, Heidi.
Well, I'm just wondering if the book does, you know, if we're going to stay within the world of the novel, is the book romanticizing that lifestyle?
It's a good question. That's a good question. There's probably a sense in which any fond remembrance of childhood,
right?
Any story like this does a little bit of that,
right?
Romanticizing, especially if childhood was a happy one.
Right. That's such a tricky question too, because to answer it, we have to wade through our own preconceived notions of childhood, our own experiences of childhood, how we feel about the Wild West personally. Like me and Adam might have very different perspectives from childhood about how much we like the Wild West.
So
start thinking about the inherent, the values that are inherent to the book is such a tricky thing. I mean, we could probably learn more about Ralph Moody and get a sense of what he thought. But man, that's a tricky thing to set aside our own preconceived notions and experiences.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I think a lot of educators, especially homeschool moms, will read this book to their kids, to their boys specifically, because there's a necessity to contribute to meaningful work that they may not feel that they have an opportunity to cultivate in their own homes, kind of give their boys a value of that. And in some sense, in order to, as you're pointing out, Adam, idealize it on purpose, right? To romanticize or idealize that because of the meaningful work that these boys had to contribute to, because they had to rise to the occasion, because they have these experiences that modern children don't have. And so in spite of the fact that there are major flaws to this kind of a lifestyle, they're not necessarily addressed or explored in this novel. They're just kind of, but it does teach this value of work and what it means to become a man and to contribute to a family in a way that our modern society doesn't really offer those same opportunities. And so I don't know. What do you guys think that there's value in that?
In that, using it for that purpose?
Yeah, even if it is overly idealized or romanticized, even if we accept that, is there a value to that, is my question for you two.
Adam?
If the question is there value in using a book like this as a child training tool to extol the benefits of working to build character and that sort of thing, because those opportunities are missing in our advanced civilization. I think there's a danger potentially in that.
Hmm.
I mean, I think the danger of romanticizing an imagined past, I think there's a lot of dangers in that, but one of them is that we don't live in the world that we've been put in. Huh. And there must be the opportunity to grow into a man of character in this technology-laden, sedentary age, because things like character still exist in this day and age.
Right.
And this is the day and age that we are actually called to work in and to live in and to become in. And so I don't know that it's completely beside the point of, you know, raising a young man of moral character and virtue by having him read Ralph Moody's book and talking about the lessons that young Ralph learned and how those might apply to today. But that's not the same thing as saying, oh, for a time when we could give them real work and teach them character.
Right.
Now they sit in the dark room eating Cheetos and we don't really even need them. Oh, woe is us. I think probably finding out how to encourage character and manhood in this day and age is more what our job is as parents, mm-hmm. certainly.
Huh.
That's why I think
my two cents.
Right.
Well, this takes us back to the article you wrote about Gatsby for us. That what's the Cicero line? O tempore.
O tempore, o mores. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, we always think the age before every generation thinks that the previous right. age was better than theirs. Right. A little more right. virtuous. But there, one of the great things about literature, one of the great things about literature is that you can get things out of it, even if you're not reading it from a utilitarian perspective.
Right.
Even if you're not trying to, you know, get a lesson out of it. And our kids tend to probably learn more lessons from literature that we don't point out to them anyway.
Right.
I would guess. I don't know that I have a scientific, and I'm prepared to make a scientific thesis about that, but
right.
Adam, you might be willing to.
I certainly think that when we read about Charlie, when we read about Ralph's dad, we love him. And the more we understand about who he is and what he's doing with our heads, the more we love him with our hearts. Mm. And we identify with Ralph, the child who looks up yeah. to his father. And the relationships that the author is drawing here are compelling to us. And they're compelling to us not because they happen in the American West.
Right.
They're compelling to us because they're universally applicable.
Mm. Right.
And that if in relationships like the one that Ralph has with Charlie, were they to happen in a dark room with a television set and a bowl of Cheetos, they would be as compelling.
Right.
And I think it's the universal nature of those relationships that gives the novel its power.
Right.
Go ahead, Heidi.
Well, I think that's really encouraging, Adam, to hear you say that, because
She's tired of reading about all these old civilizations.
Well, I think because of what I hear you saying is that we don't have to go back to some romanticized time and try to recreate it in our homes. But instead, we live fully in the season and the time in which we are. And I think that's a really important message for the mom sitting at home trying to pick out exactly the right books to train their kids to be exactly the person they want them to be. That these are not textbooks. And they're not, it doesn't mean that we have to go out and try to figure out how to make our home into the Old West in order to have young men with character. And I think that's super important. So I'm really glad you're saying that. This is a story. Enjoy the story for its own sake. Don't treat it as some kind of moral lesson in how a society is supposed to be.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I really do think that's exactly what we ought to do with a book like this, is enjoy it for the novel that it is. But to remember that, everybody has said, on the question of civilized versus uncivilized, everybody has said, who has talked about education and talked about culture and civilization, the highest point of civilization is when everyone has leisure to think and traffic in ideas.
Right, and not get beat up in the middle of the night.
Exactly. Major progress that we don't have to fight the water down through the sluice gate in the middle of the night. You know, major progress, actually, that we don't have to ride horses.
Right.
Mm.
Right. Which doesn't change the fact that our society is in some ways hurting for meaningful work. And we do have a generation of lost boys in some ways. And so something like this can provide an anchor point, but isn't necessarily something that we have to imitate in order to have.
Yeah, that's well, what
when
I was
we,
saying.
When I we romanticize,
really well said.
When we romanticize something, we're saying that they have all the answers to all our problems.
Exactly.
And so we can identify the problems we have, but that doesn't mean that they didn't also have the same problems, even though maybe the particular book that we're reading suggests that they, I mean,
it doesn't mean
that they can solve every problem.
Which is why the mom is so important as a character in the novel. Because she's the one saying, there's something wrong here. I don't want my boys just getting in fights at school and never reading books. And so I think that that's such an important point that she provides, is like the counterpoint, the one who's actually still a little worried about her kids. She's not romanticizing this society.
Mm. Yeah. So Adam, you said something a minute ago that I do want to I don't necessarily want to push back on, but I want to ask you about before we go here. So you mentioned that it's not, you know, the stories aren't, you said the stories are compelling because they're universal, not because they take place in the Old West. But, you know, don't we read genre fiction? Don't we love some of these stories because they take place in a different place than ours? Like, we do find them compelling. You know, I find spy fiction or crime fiction or Western fiction, like you, compelling, probably at least in part because of the world that it takes place in.
Right.
So can you clarify a little bit what you meant there? Because in some ways,
I agree with that request for clarification. I wouldn't want to say too much by saying it's compelling because of the universal relationships, not because of its particular setting.
Right.
We're sort of talking about using a book like this as a parenting tool, as a tool of culture.
Oh, right.
In order to pass on ideas about family and life and manhood and character to the reader, to our children. And that's kind of what I meant. In that connection, it's the universal nature of a father who's a man of character passing on his worldview to his son who looks up to his father, and they have a relationship that we want to emulate. Yeah, but I was saying that the fact that they do that on horseback ought not to figure into our use of the idea. That could be done with video game controllers in your hand just as easily, is what I'm saying. But obviously, genre fiction is compelling because of the genre, right? Yes. Westerns are compelling because of the horseback. So I totally agree with you.
And of course, the best examples of that are the things that are deeply rooted in the imaginative world, you know, imaginative to varying degrees of the genre, but also speaking to the universal things that you're talking about. When they can do both, that's where it's the most compelling. Heidi, go ahead.
I agree.
Oh, you're just listening. I look like you were about to say something. Nope. Well, we should probably wrap up. So I'll ask for final thoughts. Adam, final thoughts first from you.
Oh, no. I'm not talking anymore. I'm done.
Heidi?
I really want to have a very wise final thought, but I'm just really mulling over this question of the teaching tool and thinking on that. I think because so many mothers feel that anxiety. Which book should I read to train my kids to become the person I want them to be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And so I guess my final thought is, it isn't that Little Britches is going to be the answer to that, right? Or any book we read, but just let it be a compelling story and enjoy it. And they take from it what they do.
I always think that great books don't change our lives because of one great book being great, but it's because of that ongoing conversation that all the great books have together that we get to participate in when we read them, when we talk about them. It's not that I'm going to have my kid read The Lord of the Rings and he's going to be brave enough to go do things like what Frodo did because he read Lord of the Rings. It's the whole conversation. It's the whole life that comes from reading all these books together and having conversations about them and being in those worlds. It's not the, you know, 12,000 pages of Anna Karenina that changes my life.
Right.
That's a good point.
Okay. Yeah. You sure you don't want to say anything, Adam?
Been flapping my gums for an hour and a half.
Well, thank you for doing so. I appreciate it. Heidi, Adam, thanks again. Thanks so much. Adam, it's centerforlit.com, right?
That's right.
And what are the two podcasts that people should subscribe to?
Bibliophiles. And Radio Read Along.
And those are both available on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever people can get podcasts, right?
Correct.
All right, great.
And thanks, Heidi, for mentioning.
Of course, yeah. And Heidi's got her webinar coming up, so make sure you head over to the website and register for that. She's talking about King Arthur, as you know. So don't forget that if you like this episode, we would appreciate that you would let the world know in the form, you know, the very inconspicuous form of the starred review or the written review. And of course, if you haven't subscribed to the podcast and yet you're listening to this episode, then I'm very confused about the way you live your life and the way you consume media. And I would appreciate it if you would go click that little purple subscribe button and make sure that it pops up on your phone every time we get a new episode. Don't forget about the Daily Poem, The Place Thing, and Libromania. Coming up later today, I'm posting an episode, an interview that I did with Jessica Wilson, where we discussed Dostoevsky's gambling problem and how that influenced his work. So that was a very interesting conversation, and that's coming up later today. By the time this episode is on iTunes, you'll have hopefully already had that in your feeds, but lots of great stuff going on the Center for Lit Podcast Network, of course, and then also on all the podcasts here at Circe. So thanks for checking those out. Thanks for subscribing. Like I said, leave all the reviews, all the starred reviews. Go over to Center for Lit's feed and leave a 5-star review right now. Before you leave your podcast app, go leave that 5-star review for Center for Lit's podcasts. With that, for Adam Andrews and for Heidi White, for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Curran. Thanks so much for listening and happy reading.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.